Welcome to DOS W to David and Aaron Save the World.
Yes, indeed, we're back, baby. It's been a minute.
And not only are we back, but for this special episode, we are back in person.
Ooh. Even though that may not affect your listening experience, it definitely affects the recording experience.
That is very true. We always try to make the online edit seem like we're talking in person, but
yeah.
This will have a different feel, I think.
Right. Usually, I'm just like staring at the wall.
Yeah, I'm usually staring at our closet because yes. That's the only place where I could sit. Closet.
Somehow
the microphone.
I'm surprised. I thought the wall was sad, but the closet somehow is sadder to me. I'm like, oh, that's. Yeah.
So this is nice. And we got some improved microphones for this one so that we're sitting comfortably without having to get right up close to a tripod or anything.
Yep.
So.
Question on the microphones. Do they record in different channels? Or
they
are they
do.
The same?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So
that's really good.
Yeah, you get a left channel, a right channel. And then you just take it into mono.
Oh, okay, beautiful. So. I made a little, like, sound while you started talking, and I was like, oh, no, that's going to be a pain to edit out.
Although it would be fun to leave it as channels, so you only hear me in the left ear,
oh
and you
gosh.
Only hear Aaron in the right ear.
Oh, that would drive me crazy. That would drive me so crazy.
It's really... I've done it before, and it's really jarring when you listen to things like that.
Right.
So do not recommend. Yeah.
Because even if like you're sitting on the right side of me, I don't only hear you with my right ear.
Yeah, <That's> exactly. Not... Yeah, well, don't worry, listeners. We'll convert this to mono for you. So you can hear us pleasantly in both ears.
In both ears. As so, it was meant to be.
As it was meant to be. Anywho, should we explain why it's taken so flippin' long for us to record again?
Well, I mean, it turns out when you do things for fun, you don't do them all the time for fun.
What are you talking about? We make tons of money on all the royalty fees and things in this podcast.
All the ads you all listen to? Yeah,
exactly.
We're getting their bank. We're making bank on this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is really my full-time job, and then... You know, getting a PhD and other
getting
things
a PhD.
Is my hobby, so.
Perfect. Yeah. No, that sounds about right.
Anywho, so as a formal explanation / apology to the listeners, it's mostly my fault that it's taken so long to record.
That's not true, people. Don't listen to him. That's not true.
But to be fair, a couple of things. I have two daughters now, which means trying to record without having constant screaming or other things in the background is really hard to do in a small place because we were in two bed, one bath. And there's just no space to record over an online connection.
Yep.
And then the other thing is, as we've talked about previously on the podcast, is that I was in grad school getting my PhD, and that has finally happened. So I'm now a doctor.
He's Dr. David.
Dr. David.
Saving the world with Dr. David and Aaron.
We'll need to think of an appropriate title to put in the front.
You know, I think it's okay. I think it's perfect because I think you've worked very hard and I think it's an amazing accomplishment. How does it feel?
Feels good. Yeah. Mostly like almost like, you know, if you've had a cast on, you've ever broken an arm, you've had a cast for like 2 or 3 months and then you get it off. That's more what it feels like than anything. Like you've been slightly bothered in pain for all this time and you finally get to remove that. That's kind of what finishing grad school feels like. Cause
amazing.
You enjoy it and there's lots of, you know, you did it for a reason, right? You enjoyed it. You wanted to do this stuff, but you're always... You know, underpaid, and there's always annoying things you have to do that, you know, professors don't have to do, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You're constantly under pressure to finish and get enough publications to get, you know, and not that all those things go away, but like to finally be a real professor and like doing the thing you've been wanting to do this whole time, it's nice to be knowing I'm going into that and no longer in student mode. So
you're living the dream, man. That is the dream, is getting through the work to be where you want to be. That is the dream, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. So very excited. So I'm getting a job out on the East Coast.
Blech. Which is not where I am.
And many people around here, family especially, are sad that I'm moving, but at the same time, it'll be really good, again, because starting a first job, and also upgrading from a 2-bedroom, 1-bath to a 4-bedroom, 3-bath, which is a very big improvement. So hopefully with that increased amount of space is also increased amount of private space to record the podcast without having to worry about daughters screaming in the background.
So. Any private space at all, maybe? Because... Yeah. A 2-bed, 1-bath, there ain't nothing private about a 2-bed, 1-bath. That's the truth.
Yeah. So, the reason we're recording today is I'm moving there next week. And so we wanted to get one more in-person recording down before I headed off.
On his next big adventure.
On the next big adventure. And so...
It's amazing.
This is a special episode, but also hopefully more episodes to come.
Right, right.
Now that we can get a routine down, and
I am feeling confident and hopeful about that because it's I've been missing it. I've been excited for this recording this episode,
and then watch this go another year before I record.
Yeah.
No, it'll be every 6 months,
right?
Not every
right.
That, year and a half.
Every year, yeah, year and a half. Oh. We were looking. I was looking over the notes, and one of the notes just says, "We should call it a yearly podcast." And I was like, yeah. "Oh no, that wasn't the dream when we started."
That was my note. I do feel bad because we started out really strong.
Yeah.
We were recording like twice a month at first, and then
it slowed down to
once a month, and then you got married, and I got married, and like it just got further and further apart.
Yep. Every episode gets further and further.
But that's gonna change.
Yep. We're here.
We're here now.
And we're doing another one, and it's not dead, even though all signs would point to it being dead.
Never give up on it. We'll always be here.
We'll always be here.
You never know.
That's
you never
true.
Know when
we have,
an episode comes.
Our out. Voices, as long as the internet survives, our voices will live on.
That's true.
Forever. In eternum.
That's right.
And with AI
stuff, eventually we could just make episodes where I just type up what we say and we don't have to record.
Yes. The future. Where we can just compose.
Just compose a podcast.
I think that kind of defeats the point of the two dudes talking podcast.
Well, please laugh here.
Yeah. Laughter. Intense laughter. Subdued laughter. Noise of acknowledgement.
Yeah, it's true. Like you said. Unlike what we were saying at the beginning, we don't actually do this for money, right?
So like, right, yeah.
If we're no longer enjoying doing this part, then yeah, we probably should stop recording.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anywho, we have a lot of follow-up. Well, I have a lot of follow-up specifically.
Yep. I came prepared with nothing, so David is pulling the wagon this time.
Well, it turns out when you take like a year and a half break between episodes, a lot of things come up, happen in the world that are worth noting about.
All right.
So, and also on these follow-ups, we're going like really far back here. So, see if Aaron even remembers some of these episodes.
I wouldn't count on it.
So I will remind Aaron as we go along, and the listeners, which is probably good, right?
Yeah.
For those people that don't happen to just have every one of our episodes memorized by number and
seriously.
Content. But you will recall in one of our earlier episodes that we talked about knee pads in pants.
Okay.
Aaron specifically also works a lot on his knees and stuff, and so he was pointing out the premier pants that you need when you're working, and those always include knee pads in the pants.
Mm-hmm.
one of our solutions we were talking about to avoiding having to specifically purchase those kinds of pants when you work was to have pants that have airbags inside of them that inflates when you fall to the ground and cushion that fall.
Yep.
When that was presented, I considered that a completely unreasonable solution.
I agree hearing it now.
But it turns out that actually exists now. So I'm going to show Aaron the picture that I found from a link on an article I saw.
Oh, boy.
So apparently they make pants for motorcyclists that have airbags inside of them. Huh. With the idea that when you fall, or if there's some crash or something, or just, you know, you fall off the motorcycle, somehow it detects that you're falling, and the airbags in your pants inflate
yeah,
and cushion your fall. Aaron, what are your initial thoughts when you look at that picture?
Well, what? It's I feel like that marketing image is not their best work. I got some problems with just the very marketing of it.
We'll make sure to include this picture in the show notes
for people. Yes. My only real question is, do they work? Because if they work... No, you know what? I don't really have any questions, actually. This is very strange.
To describe the picture a little bit, it shows a picture of the jeans. It's a pair of jeans specifically without the airbag on. And then it just shows the picture from the angle of the butt of it inflated. And so it just is like a picture that looks like somebody's butt has just blown up or grown or something. It looks really awkward.
It looks like you're intro to photo editing class. And you've just taken like one of the editors and just like...
Yeah, the inflate tool and just like blows up the area. That's exactly what it looks like. I wouldn't be surprised if they used that to make that picture.
Well, I mean, it looks like a real picture, though, because I noticed that this whole section is exploded out, and that's probably the mechanism that does the inflating, but I just...
And to be fair, I don't know how to market that any better.
Me neither. Yeah, no.
It's just such an awkward picture and such an awkward idea of I have an explosive material in my pants. Anyways.
Do they market one for the top half of the body? If you only cover the bottom half, the top half's pretty important.
Yeah, that's true.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I would say it's pretty important.
I think they're going for, like, Darth Maul style. Like, if they can save your head and save your, like, lower body, maybe they can piece together something in the middle. Or I guess... he's the opposite. But, you know, they're hoping for some cyborg kind of stuff going on.
That makes sense, yeah.
Anywho, so would you agree that even if this is solving the problem, it's perhaps not the best way to go about it?
I just want to see the statistics. I just want to know if it works. If it works...
Then go for it.
Then go for it. I... don't desire to ride a motorcycle, and so doesn't concern me. It doesn't look like it's going to work for my purposes, though. Because my purpose is crawling around on the ground, climbing in and out of cabinets.
True.
I don't really want to be, like, inside a cabinet and then have my have my pants suddenly inflate, trapping me in said cabinet.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a good day, so...
Suddenly your butt grew 3 sizes bigger, and now you can't get back out of the hole.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
Again, I think it's just the funny way they chose to market it just cracked me up. And yeah, it's true. But my question is also, like, just thinking of its specific purpose, how does it know that you're falling off a motorcycle or you've been in a crash? Like, you know, how does it know that versus just like, oh, I'm trying to get on my motorcycle and I tipped over, right? You know, like, because in a car, it makes sense that... there's a point when the car feels the impact.
Right.
And in that space between when the car is first hit and when you are going to feel that impact.
No.
The airbag can inflate in between those two points.
Right. Nice and quick.
But if you're a motorcyclist, you're the first thing that feels the impact. So how can you inflate before you've been hit? You know, like, how does it tell that? I'd be curious on the exact parameters the accelerometers in there must be using to determine that.
Well, there has to be like surely you have to turn it on.
Yeah.
Like, maybe not. I assume you'd have to turn it on, like prime it somehow to be like, okay, now I'm riding the bike. No, it wouldn't work. No, you can't have that. If it's going to be a safety thing, it has to deploy automatically.
In my mind, it can only work in like a head-on collision with a motorcycle.
Right.
Because then it would feel the acceleration before the motorcyclist probably would go flying. Right. And then hopefully this airbag like prevents them from having more damage when they hit the ground. But like if you get sideswiped or if you like fall off the motorcycle for some reason, like it wouldn't know that you've had that much force until you've hit the ground. And
I mean, maybe there is a threshold where it'll activate. So maybe you could get it to deploy prematurely, like if you trip or something.
Right.
Maybe it does deploy prematurely because it is that sensitive. Because there has to be a point at which, like, the acceleration is an impact versus just regular stuff. I don't know, man. I don't know. Because then you hit a pothole and all of a sudden, well, it's bad to hit a pothole on a motorcycle, but you hit a pothole and all of a sudden your pants are...
Right. I mean, we probably could, like, read the article, and it probably explains all this, but I'd rather just, like...
Bish-bosh.
I'd rather just guess based on this awkward picture.
Yeah. To consider the implications and use our thinking, our mental minds, to figure it out.
Right. It's like the old story of Aristotle or someone back in Greek times, you know, where they had this whole debate on, like, how many teeth a horse has. And one of the people was like, well, why don't we just go out and, like, count? And they're like, are you crazy? You know? And they, like, banished him from the school. I don't know if it's true. But I like that mentality. Like, rather than just going and find the solution, let's actually just keep debating about it.
Until... Right. You're missing the point. The point is not to know the answer. The point is to think about what could be the answer.
Is to make sure you have the right answer and the other person has the wrong answer.
Yes, exactly. There's no other... We didn't actually want to know. It's not important because it's not relevant.
Right, and if we know, then we can't mock it as much.
Exactly. It can't be part of the...
This is what the society is built on, you know?
Exactly.
Mockery based on lack of information.
That is a very disappointing thought. But true. I feel it. I hang out on the internet enough. I know.
Anywho, we should probably move on to our next follow-up.
Next follow-up, let's go.
This one will be less mockery. This is actually a problem well solved.
Oh.
It's actually a problem well solved for a problem that I brought up in an earlier episode.
Mm-hmm.
You may recall I talked about when I had to recycle one of our big screen TVs, our flat screen TVs.
Okay, I don't recall.
It was busted, and turns out no one would take the TV... because it didn't have enough recyclable material and all this stuff.
What?
And I can't remember all the details. I was going to try and build it into a table or something. And yeah, this is like 5 years ago at this point.
Right, yeah.
Anyways, but going back to that, one of our frustrations was that it's really hard to recycle electronic material.
Mm.
And they always want you to take it to like a specific plant or other things like that. But recently, within the last year, Best Buy and Amazon and a few other companies have agreed to start taking products for e-recycling.
Amazing.
Which is a huge deal because it was such a pain in the butt to do before.
That's a good... That's a really good solution.
Yeah, it's such a simple solution. I never don't understand why it took so long for this to happen. But,
right.
Like, for example, with this move, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm moving to the East Coast, there's a bunch of computers and phones. My wife calls it the technology graveyard in our house.
Oh, I have one of those too. Yep.
Because it is one of those things. I'm not a huge hoarder. Mm-hmm. I don't like to hoard onto stuff. But I struggle with technology because I'm always like, oh, maybe I'll use this for that purpose later. Mm-hmm. Or I could always, I need this cord because you never know when you need to connect an old stereo to your TV. You know? Like, yep, yep. I always keep random cords yep. and technology and stuff. But finally with the mover, like, okay, we can't take like four boxes of crap with us that have no purpose, right?
Right, yeah.
So I got like a bunch of laptops and a bunch of old phones Oof. On different trips and took them to Best Buy and just said, I need to recycle these. And they're like, yep, okay, take it to customer service. They, you know, put it in their box.
Put it in the bin, yeah.
Give you a little receipt if you want it. And
amazing.
You know, it's like, why has this taken so long? It's such a simple solution. I should be able to recycle products from a company that works with technology all the time. They should be capable of handling
exactly
this system. So,
well, and I don't want to sound too like anti-capitalism in this moment, but like, these companies definitely profit off of the sale of these electronics.
Right.
Like, obviously, the people also profit. Like, I get a lot of use out of my electronics, and I use them a lot, and I'm the one who's actually, like, receiving benefits, but they also yeah. receive the monetary benefits. And so it feels like a nice way to for them to give back.
Yeah.
Is how it kind of feels. Like, I gave yeah. you the money, and now you're going to be full service electronic. Not just give me the electronic. Now you're going to do the whole thing. Right. You're going to sell me the stuff. Well, and honestly, I can see benefits in getting people into your store as well.
Right.
I don't go into Best Buy unless I need to buy something specific. But if I have electronics to recycle, maybe I'll kick around, browse yeah. around a little bit.
Look see for if your there's next anything. Buy that you want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See if you guys got anything. It just makes sense. Yeah. It's just a really useful, helpful solution. Yeah. I'm really glad about that. That makes me really happy.
And again, I feel like if I told most people that, they'd be like, oh, like, doesn't Best Buy always do that? But like, it's been like within the last year. Like, wow. It's a very recent thing because you remember my frustration with it earlier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So. Well, and it's really difficult to, like, you have to find the place or the...
Well, again, it's maybe super distant. Like, for me, it was like an hour drive to the nearest electronics recycle. Ah. But now that's just a Best Buy or whatever company, you know, like... So nice. So simple. Nice.
Yes, yes. Congratulations, Best Buy. Yes. And all the other companies that do it. I know there's more.
And to the world for now having a simple way to recycle
yes,
their electronics.
Yes, we gotta get on that, guys. Or else all my books will be right.
Anyway. We'll get to those later. Don't worry.
Yes, 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 yes.
We got some interesting books to talk about. So to the next follow-up item, I'm glad we got a problem well solved in there. But this mm-hmm. one is still I'm not sure if it's a problem well solved or where it fits in this.
Okay.
Yard sales. So yeah. Again, in an earlier episode, we talked about yard sailing and my yes. confusion at it, but also your experience doing it. Yes. But again, with the moves, since we're moving to the East Coast, we decided to take all of our junk
mm-hmm.
and do a yard sale, mm-hmm. which is the first time I've ever done it.
Oh,
so it was yeah. really eye-opening to try and do a yard sale.
That's going to be do tell.
So Saturday morning, we had all our stuff ready of what we wanted to put out. Got a few tables, got a big tarp.
Mm-hmm.
Just laid it out
off on the ground. Big tarp on the yep, mm-hmm. yep.
And just
beautiful.
Threw a bunch of stuff on our front lawn. I got some stickers so that like some things were 25 cents and some things were $1 and some things were just like right on the label kind of thing. And just started putting them all over on the place
mm-hmm.
based on your recommendations from last descriptions.
I hope I had good recommendations.
But what was interesting is we got this all out, you know, and I got a sign. It was a little bit trickier getting people there. But the nice thing was we had Facebook had a yard sale page that we could post to.
Mm-hmm.
We're not, like, off a super major road, so that was the hard part. Was it just like, hey, yard sale, because no one really drives by that area a ton.
Right, right.
But we had one sign on a kind of major road, so hopefully we got a few that way. We saw probably 14 people, 15 people overall, which wasn't bad, you know, for 4 hours. But I guess we started late because we went from 10 a.m. till like 2 p.m.
Oh, David, oh no.
I was curious if you were going to agree with this.
Oh, no.
My father-in-law does a lot of yard selling, like going to yard sales. And he's like, yeah, I usually start at 7. And I was like, whoa, 7?
Yep. And before the sun crests the mountains, you need to be out and ready. Because that is the couple of hours in that morning time, those are the primo hours. It's not too hot yet. It's just, there's the little bit of coolness, the summer coolness in the air. And that's when all the people are out hunting. It's the perfect time.
See, but this is what boggles my mind. Because I don't yard sale. I would never get up early to go look at other people's stuff. And so in my mind, I'm like, oh, logically, I'd want to do it like later in the day, at least 9, 10. Because people have gone up and gone ready for the day. And then they're ready to go yard selling. But I'm misunderstanding the demographic.
Yeah,
that yes. Goes to these things.
I am so sorry that I was not able to stop this. It is
part of me wanted to invite you to come, but I think you were out of town or something.
Oh, yeah, day. I saw it and I was like, oh, I want to come, but I can't. I'm busy or something. I don't remember what I was doing.
But yeah, I should have at least like done a phone call with you and gotten like expert advice on the matter.
I saw your Facebook event, but I didn't look at it past the date.
Did it connect the time?
And I didn't think about, yeah, I didn't, yeah, we started a couple of our biggest yard sales. We started, I mean, early, like 4 or 5, getting stuff ready and prepped and moving stuff out into the lawn and yeah.
I think that was part of it too, is like, just logistically, I'm like, I can't get up at, you know, 6 and try and get stuff out the door while the girls are still asleep. And,
oh, you know, so. Yep. Okay.
But even with that, again, we didn't see a ton of people.
Mm-hmm.
But here was the other thing. Apparently, I priced things too cheap. Because I was, you know, going around with stickers. And most of the things I did like $1.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Even like furniture items. I was like, a dresser, $1. Why not?
Why not?
Because that's my problem is, I just want to get rid of it. I don't really care how much money I get out of this. I just want someone to come grab it.
Right, right.
And so
it's not like a fundraiser. It's not like a, because we were rolling fundraisers back in the day. Whenever we did a big yard sale, it was because we were trying to save up for one of the kids something or other.
Right.
And you're just trying to be free.
Yeah. So I think that my mentality was wrong too, because like, that's why we still got rid of a lot of stuff, because someone would come by and they'd get like everything, because they're like, oh, I can get all this for $20, sure. You know, like we had one little family come by and we had a lot of like kids stuff, right? Yeah. And so like little kids are like, oh, like this toy, you know, and they're like, okay, you know, that's 25 cents, great, just throw in the car. So the kids were having a blast and yeah, parents were happy because they got all these new toys for you know, super cheap. And
it's Christmas in June, man. Yeah. That's how it works.
It was just funny because like I probably could have made a lot more money if I had researched it.
Yeah.
But I just have a hard time because it's just like, it's my junk. I don't want it. Mm-hmm. I just want someone to take it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't care how much you pay me for it. Just get it off my lawn.
Yep. I think you did the right thing. I think that's the right way to treat it and the right way to go about it. You don't have a yard sale. I was in a situation where I was also considering another yard sale a few years back, and I go to talk to my mom about it because she's the one who, you know, spearheaded all the all the fundraising yard sales, and the conclusion that she came to and that she told me was that you don't really do a yard sale to make money. It's not really, that's not really the goal and not really the best way to go about it. There's better things you could do with your time that would raise the money. And so I think you did it right. I think it's all right.
I mean, again, I'm not sad because I got rid of stuff, right? The other thing is like, okay, I learned a lot of things for the next yard sale. The problem is like, when is the next yard sale going to be? Am I going to remember this in, you know, 6 years, 10 years?
Right.
So maybe I'll just make all the mistakes again and then.
That's fine.
But again, as long as it's serving my purposes, I guess it's fine, right?
Yeah. It did its job. It got rid of the stuff. And that's really what we needed. Perfect.
Alrighty, so we have one more follow-up item, but we wanted to take a break, as you just heard, because this follow-up item will lead into one of our main discussion topics for today.
Yep.
So the follow-up item goes back to episode 8, I think it is.
Is that when we did that?
I think so. I can't remember the numbers anymore, but...
I don't know.
One of the episodes early on, you may recall, we talked a lot about a book called Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke.
Ah, yes.
And you'll recall that we both really liked the book. But we said at the time that we wouldn't think it would make a good movie because as soon as you make the trailer, you basically ruin the movie because the whole movie is about exploration and getting to explore a space you haven't seen before and understand an alien species that you know nothing about.
Right.
That kind of mentality, right?
And the pure lack of action and the lack of, like, I feel like the lack of things that actually happen. Like, there's not really a lot of stuff
that happens. It's a very slow, meticulous, discover one point at a time kind of style.
Yep.
And so, I don't know yet if this is good or bad, but they are making a Rendezvous with Rama movie. But the only reason that it might be good is because of who's directing it.
Yes! Yes!
I can't remember how to say his name. Villeneuve, or
please, everyone forgive me if this is wrong, but I believe it's Denis Villeneuve.
Ah, yes.
Because it's French, and it's spelled Denis Villeneuve.
Right.
But they don't say it like that, and no one... The only other person that I know who knows these kinds of things says Villeneuve. Villeneuve. So, but it's my boy Denis Villeneuve, and he's coming, and he's gonna do Rendezvous with Rama, and I'm so excited.
I'd be excited if any other director was doing it.
No,
but for those that don't know him, you probably know him most from making the Dune movies. Now, and part 2 is coming out, but we'll have to talk about that later.
Yes, I'm so excited.
And Dune was probably one of the most interesting movies I've seen, and we've had this discussion off the podcast, that the pacing of Dune, the movie, was the most similar I've ever felt to actually reading a book.
Yeah.
That, like, I was watching a movie, but I felt like I was reading chapters. Like, the pacing was just enough... You know, there was some slow parts, but, like, it would just pulled me enough to get me into the next chapter and pulled me enough into the next chapter. I felt like I was reading a book.
Yes.
So if anyone can get the pacing right of Rendezvous with Rama, it's Villeneuve. I can never say his name.
My boy, Villeneuve.
Villeneuve, yes.
I agree 100%. This is... as I've come into adulthood... I've realized that he is an amazing director, and he's an amazing director for me because he has that pacing down perfectly. And so he's done Dune. That was his most recent movie, and he's coming out with Dune Part 2. And then supposedly after Dune Part 2, it's Rendezvous with Rama. That's the rumors that I've heard.
Right.
I don't know that for sure. But that's the rumors, and they look very good, and I'm very excited. So he's also done a movie called Sicario. He did Blade Runner 2049, the sequel or whatever to the original Blade remake. Runner. Exactly, the kind of remake sequel, yeah, which is also amazing. And he also did Arrival.
Oh, that's right.
And Arrival's the one that makes me feel the most excited for
Rendezvous.
Yeah, exactly.
Very similar mentality, right?
Exactly. It's like an exploration. It's a learning process. I actually recently read the short story that Arrival comes from, and I just think he's gonna do it. I think he's gonna pull it off. I've never seen someone with such a perfect repertoire, like leading into one of my all-time favorite books. Like,
right.
Just if anyone can do it, he can do it. And if he can't do it, no one can do it, as far as I know. Like, I just don't think anyone else can do it. Although, interestingly, This is a thought I haven't had before. But
I wish I could describe Aaron's face right now. It's a beautiful winker face.
So, yeah. Anyway, I'm gonna put that aside. I'll bring that up later. There's time for that later. But I'm just so excited. I just think it's gonna be. He's got the pacing. He's got the visuals. We're at the day and age of science fiction movies where it all looks so good.
Right.
Watching Dune. Oh, Dune was amazing. It was so good. And then the ornithopters, and I'm like, please, please, Villeneuve, you can do it. Please, you can do it. I'm so excited for everything he makes and everything he's produced, and it's all just been stunning work. With exactly that pacing that I think is the most important part.
Right.
For the book and for the experience.
You know what was one of the most interesting experiences I have had? I was actually watching Arrival because I couldn't go to sleep the night I watched it.
Okay.
And I woke up, I was in and out of sleep and woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I just decided to watch Arrival for some reason at 4 o'clock in the morning, which was the perfect time because the whole movie takes place in the early morning when the sun is rising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of dusk. Dawn, early dawn outside. It was also early dawn in the movie. It was this weird experiential moment where I felt I was in the movie as slowly I was gaining more information. I was also probably sleep deprived.
Well, I can't think of a better time to watch any of the. Yeah, that's a perfect time.
So
it was
a really weird symbiosis that was going on when I was watching the movie. So.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was really fun, actually. I was wow. Something just feels magical about this moment as I'm watching this movie.
Something's just right.
So, hopefully he nails it.
Yep.
And we'll have good things to say.
Yep.
Come 2 years or so from now, if not.
Oh, movies take so long. It drives me crazy, people.
If he doesn't nail it, get ready for a big vent session.
Yep.
Come a few episodes down the road.
Oh, we're just going to if he nails it, it's just going to be a really short episode. Yep, it was perfect.
Yep.
Done.
He did it again.
Yep. That'll be the whole episode. The whole podcast episode.
Just the title, He Did It.
He did it.
30 seconds.
Well, people, he did it. No. We won't even record a new one. We'll just snip that voice section out and just plop it in there. Perfect.
Okay, so we'll keep you posted on that.
Yes.
But that's our last follow-up item for today. But we wanted to end on that one because we need to talk about sci-fi.
Yes, yes. I convinced David into doing a two-man sci-fi book club with me because I was getting really frustrated with reading. I read a lot of science fiction, and I was getting really frustrated with not having anyone to talk about the readings that I was doing with because there's so much, and it's so interesting, and I have so many thoughts, and I wanted to bring someone along on this experience, and so David has come along with me on the experiences, so we've been reading slowly but surely many books.
There's just a small level of extortion to get
extortion.
No, I'm just kidding. Actually, what convinced me was Rendezvous with Rama. We did that a few years back, and again, I'm not a sci-fi reader. Honestly, I'm not a reader of many books at the start of for fun kind of books,
Yeah, Dr. David doesn't spend his time reading books.
Dr. David has too many textbooks to read. That's why he doesn't read for
long. There's no fun reading here. There's only work. It's only accomplishment.
But we really want to do Rendezvous with Rama, and that one was so good for science fiction that you convinced me to come with you into this journey of reading through a lot of the science fiction novels and some of the classics. So, like you said, we made a list. We started doing books and kind of decided when we were going to finish. And we've read about 4 or 5 now together, at least.
Is that how many we've read?
Yeah, because we've done The Martian Chronicles.
Oh, yeah!
We've done Space Odyssey, which we'll definitely need to talk about.
Oh, yes.
and a book called Bobiverse.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one, which I never finished, called Children of Time.
Oh, yeah. I dropped that one. I was reading in pace with my brother, and then he stopped reading, and I stopped reading to keep pace with him. And then, like, a couple other people that I had told about that, a couple other family members, like, had been reading it with me, and they just kept going. And so they finished, and I'm still stuck in the middle of it.
And then I read, when I dropped that one, I read a few others without you, because you were still reading. So I did Fahrenheit 451, which we'll need to discuss if that even qualifies as sci-fi. And The Man in the High Castle.
The Man in the High Castle.
Which also is more alternate history.
Okay.
So, there's two we definitely want to talk about today, and that's Bobiverse and Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I also just want to talk about, this is Save the World, right? Like, what makes good sci-fi that's worth reading?
Yes.
That's a deeper discussion, I think, overall.
Yeah. Well, and I...
Should we start with Bobiverse? Because I feel like we have the most ground to cover with that one.
Or
do we end with that and let it just bleed to however long it needs to go?
No. We can get started with it. I've been excited to talk about it. Let's see. I'm getting my notes out.
While Aaron gets his notes out, I'll give a short summary of the book. I won't give you all the details, but I'll give you kind of the premise here.
Right. And heads up, from here on out, this is spoiler territory for both of these books. This is 2001, A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. And
Are Legion, We Are Bob. Is that the official title?
Yeah, we are. Yeah,
that's a weird title.
It's We Are Legion, We Are Bob, Bobiverse Book One. That's like the series is Bobiverse, look it up. Okay, that's all I have to say about that. And that's by Dennis E. Taylor. Right. And so those are the two books we're going to be discussing in depth. And spoilers, get ready.
Yeah. If these are books you're seriously considering reading, pause this episode until you can read those.
Turn back now.
So, beware. Premise for Bobiverse, book one. The idea is a guy that lives in our current time, he gets interested in cryogenic freezing. Is that the official term?
Cryogenic,
thank you. And he pays for someone that when he dies, they are going to freeze his head.
Yep.
Preserve his brain.
Yep.
And so he dies, and he wakes up down the road, and he's not actually a person. He's basically a robot that they've put all his memories into, etc. And specifically, they saved him for the purpose of having him be like a kind of an AI system for them. Mm-hmm. But he's an actual person, so he's not artificial intelligence. He's real intelligence. And he's going to help this nation, this nation state at the time with their space program, etc. And then he can actually replicate into other versions of himself to continue expanding and helping and all this stuff. And then things start to go bad, and he basically has to solve everybody's problems.
Is
that a fair summary?
That is a perfect summary. I love it. He has to solve everyone's problems, and that is what... That is how it comes together, isn't it? That's beautiful. It's. The only thing I'd add is that it's... I wouldn't add anything. That's a perfect summary, and I think it's good starting grounds for chit-chatting about it.
Okay.
So we haven't actually talked about it yet since we've read it.
Right.
So what did you think?
I liked it.
Okay.
And I'm surprised I liked it, if that is weird to say.
No, that makes sense, yeah.
So this will go into the deeper discussion as well of what makes good sci-fi. But I generally like when sci-fi is tied in some way to some overarching theme about society or something. You know, it makes a commentary on our current society.
Right.
And this doesn't have a ton of that in terms of, like, I mean, there's lots of things you could discuss about it.
Right.
But it's not the focus, like, a lot, you know. It's not a Fahrenheit 451 by any means, right? Or any of these dystopian ones you see.
Right.
It's much more about the capabilities of this system that relies on a human intelligence and can replicate and can create its own things. And I enjoyed that aspect way too much.
Yes, dude. Yes.
Because secretly, if I've always wanted to be a robot.
Yes.
So, like, reading him going through the details of why he makes decisions and what he ends up building, and like, I was loving it. It's like, oh yeah, that's logical. That's what I would do in that situation. If I had that capability, of course, I would add to this. So it was like fueling my desire to like have technology embedded into my life in that way.
Oh yes. So. It's living out that dream of it implants this beautiful dream of like, I could be like a spaceship in space and I could just be there and it would be lovely and wonderful and there would be things to do and problems to solve. Right. It's literally just living out that fantasy.
Yeah.
And I've never considered it, but yeah, you might be the most Bob person in my life. It's like you and my dad, you guys are competing.
So if you see me sign up for a cryogenic freezing service,
yes,
you know why. But yeah, so as you said, I love the parts where he's like trying to make a decision and like he's changing the frame speed that he's making calculations to determine how long he'll be like determining that decision and things.
Right.
It was just, I loved it. I'm like, oh yeah, like I would slow down at this point to make sure I'm really accurate about this calculation. Or yeah, this is boring. I'll speed up how fast time goes for me, etc.
It gives a lot of the like video game controls into reality. And so you have the ability to manipulate reality in the ways that you've been able to in video games for our entire lives. And so it's like, this is amazing. So I'll give a little more context for more of our talking. So it's like, it's exactly like you said, he gets cryogenically frozen. And then at some point in the future, he's reawakened. I never realized how much he sidesteps that conversation. Like, I don't feel like they actually have that conversation in the book about how it's like, does he count as like a computer intelligence? Right. Or does he count as I guess it does start to come up later. Yeah.
Again, there wasn't a ton of like social commentary or that kind of commentary.
Yeah.
Which is why, again, so surprised I enjoyed it so much.
But. And there might be more. I actually, so I've read this series once before. Once or twice before. So this is like my second or third time through it. And then there's actually another book out in the series this time around. So I read all four books. David only read the first one. And I think there's more of that commentary. Like it creeps in.
And I'm sure, I'm sure to finish some of these plot lines, it's going to get more and more along that. But yeah.
Exactly.
Continue the story from there.
Right. So he, and his purpose exactly is, he's going to be a von Neumann probe. And this was actually one of my notes that I took about it. At the beginning of the book, I love that they have accurate like convention scenery. Like he goes through, cause he's at a science fiction conference and Taylor uses the science fiction conference to actually lay out what the book is going to be about. Like he uses like the panels and the convention and the scenery to kind of to have discussions and have lectures.
They're talking about the future of robotics and things at the conference, and can you 3D print things and have them 3D print themselves, and that's like their topic of discussion at the sci-fi conference, which is exactly what he does later on.
Exactly. And so the whole premise is like basically that he's a von Neumann probe, which is a type of spaceship that is a self-replicating spaceship that can explore the universe in a more timely manner than humanity will ever be able to.
Right.
At our current pace, it's a spaceship that can, each system it goes to can then replicate into multiple spaceships and continue the exploration in kind of
you go to one system, you get resources there to build various versions of that same spaceship. They all go out. Mm-hmm. They all find systems that get resources. They all build versions of themselves. And then you get this exponential exploration factor going on among the probes.
I was desperately searching for the word exponential in my mind. I was like, what is that word? It's not quadratic. It's something else, though. It's an exponential, exactly, an exponential exploration of the universe. And so that gives you the fastest and most convenient way to find habitable worlds, which is, you know, a key pillar of science fiction.
Right.
Is humanity not staying on the planet.
Right.
And going to other planets, because that's exciting, exploratory, and fun. And it's what we want to, what I dream about. Anyway. And so I just love that he uses the convention and like a useful, he depicts it so accurately, and that he uses that as a narrative.
It's a very good, like, almost prologue to the book, even though it's not the prologue. It's almost like a, here's your textbook reading you need before you start the book, but you're not, it doesn't feel like you're reading it.
Right. Let's catch you up real quick on a couple of concepts we're going to be talking about. let's see. What did you think about roamers?
Remind me about the roamers.
Those are the spiders that he uses to do everything.
Oh, on the actual planets?
On the spaceships and the planets, yeah.
I didn't think about them too much, actually. Yeah. I think that's part of it, is like, I wasn't in the super, to your point, right? Like,
yeah.
The whole process of like material to creating something is not like super well defined in the books overall.
Oh yeah, no.
So there is a little bit of waving of hand, if you will, like, oh, I send down the roamers and then I have the materials I need.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It didn't bother me, but I wasn't really thinking about it.
Okay. Yeah. I just think they're really cool. They're like some spiders, like little, I think they're like 4 or 6-legged, like robotic spiders that come in different sizes and can manipulate all sorts of things. And definitely one of the hand wavy things about the book. I've come to love science fiction hand waving. Because there's so many times in science fiction where it's like, you know, sometimes to tell the story you want to tell, you just have to wave your hands a little bit.
Right.
But we're not going to do the fantasy thing where it's all made up. Like,
right.
We still have, we wanted something real.
Appropriate hand waving.
Exactly.
That's a better solution than the, I'm going to try to define something that doesn't actually work.
Right.
That's
right,
the worst. Yep. It's like, oh, well, let me give a bad scientific explanation for how this is running. It's like,
right,
then you just lost me, because you're just making up garbage.
Right
If you don't pretend to know it, then that's fine, but like, don't make up garbage for me. Throw it in there. Yeah, I can see your point on that.
Well, and then like, you dive off into more hardcore science fiction, and there's sometimes you can end up with a book like The Martian, where it's very interesting, but also kind of like reading a spreadsheet sometimes, because
super technical.
He's very much explaining every little thing to prove that it would work.
Right.
That's fun in its own realm. And in hardcore sci-fi, love it. He's gonna love it.
Almost like reading a mathematical proof or something.
Yeah. It can be a little dry though, as far as narrative goes. Oh man.
That leads to another thing I did like. Continuing the story, right? So he's supposed to do this, but there are warring nation states on the Earth. And this is the most social commentary there was about the various nations fighting with each other.
Yeah.
In kind of a, not post-nuclear area yet, but just, I can't remember if there was nukes or not, but things are not good.
That's the summary. I think it's still pre-nuclear war.
Oh, that's right, because they kind of start into it.
Yeah.
So right as he leaves Earth, basically that leaving of the von Neumann probe of him, of Bob, kind of triggers a arms race that leads to a nuclear war. And so by the time he gets back from the solar system he went to, because he sends out himself out, those all replicate, and he sends one of his versions of himself back to Earth to see how things are going.
Exactly.
And they're in nuclear war, and most of the population is decimated, and he's trying to solve all their problems. So this was So this is the other thing. Quick note. One thing I really appreciate is that he didn't have any explosives on board.
Yeah.
Or like blasting weapons, but he just basically takes pieces of metal, like these round balls, and just shoots them at super high speeds at people. And it's like, that makes total sense, because there's competing probes that come from the other nations.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, like, rather than shoot missiles or anything, he just shoots a super fast metal ball, and it works. And it's like, yeah, that would totally work. Why do you need an explosive in space? Like, it's right. not really necessary, you know? And so I appreciated that point.
On that, honestly, this book has been one of the most... It pairs both the most interesting narrative with some of the best descriptions of how I think true space battles
work. Yeah.
Like, it's all very momentary.
They're
like it just lasts just a second.
And then, like, they're hiding it. They're, like, using orbits around, like, asteroids and moons to, like, hide and, like, sneak up on each other. It's like, yeah, you would totally do that because you don't have anything else to hide behind, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to, like, follow gravity still, you know, because you're in the solar system.
Yep.
Yeah, so the space battles are really interesting.
Amazing. So good.
And, yeah, I just like that point. Like, yeah, I wouldn't want to store explosive materials on myself. I would just want to store metal and just shoot it at, you know? And that was his point. He's like, I'm not going to store missiles on myself. I don't want something to go wrong.
This is dangerous. This is dangerous. I don't want to die.
Yeah.
I've already died once, so don't want to do that again.
But yeah, the other thing I appreciate about this book, going into, because he keeps splitting up, right? Mm-hmm. That was one of the most fun things about this book was like, there's not just one narrative.
Yeah.
Because once he splits into the different versions, there's one that is going back to Earth and trying to solve Earth's problems. Mm-hmm. There's one that's in that first solar system that's like the main reconnaissance and like communication hub. And they're like trying to build ways to talk to more of the probes as they go further out, you know, and trying to solve like speed of light problems and things like that. And like one of the Bobs is just like, okay, I'll do it. You know, it might take 6 years, but I'll just churn on it. Cause he just can, cause he's a robot and he's half human, half robot and can like
lives functionally forever.
And yeah. You know,
like
so,
whatever, we got time to.
Yeah. So he's working on that. And then there's another Bob that is running into the other probes and doing warfare basically with them. And so there's just so many fun stories going on that you felt like you're never too bored with one storyline. You know, you're always excited to see what's going on in this place. Like what happened here? Like,
And
the other thing that was weird is like some of the Bobs die, you know, cause they run into other probes or, you know, an uninhabitable solar system. Then they're just gone. And you're like, whoa, like, that's weird, but you know, that's what would happen, you know? Like they went on a suicide mission, but there's another one, you know. You're okay. Like
it pairs it's got a very interesting dynamic of that, like there's functionally infinite numbers of Bobs now, but like
do we still care about individuals?
Yeah, exactly. And we still are treating each one as an individual. I think he gives a lot of good characteristics to make Bob both like really logical, but also really like human and likable. And he wants to retain his humanity. He's not all bent out of shape. He doesn't want to become a mindless robot.
Right. Yeah. To that point. Cause like when the Bobs do die, like they're like memorialized and like they try to save them sometimes through like backups because like there's backups of those versions of it. You know?
Right.
It's just a weird, it's fun to think about, but you're right. He also kind of saves that humanity piece of it, which is really cool.
That's such a good, and honestly, dude, it gets, someday you're going to have to read the other books because it just gets more and more intense.
That's what I was wondering, if it just gets harder and harder to keep track of all the different storylines.
It doesn't get too hard. He keeps to a number of storylines that I think is
manageable.
Yeah. Throughout the books. He intended to write the first trilogy. And so the first trilogy follows a pretty specific story arc between the three books. And you follow kind of the people you meet in the first book are kind of the people you stay with throughout the rest of the books.
Right.
But oh man, it gets crazy. It gets really interesting because one of the things they talk about in the book is that, replicative drift, which is simply a term that they use to define the difference between each time he clones himself. Every time he makes a new Bob, the Bob is a little different personality-wise.
There's personality traits that amplify or decrease slightly.
Exactly. And I think that's, I also love that he includes that in the book. Like, it kind of feels like obviously he has to, but at the same time, he didn't have to. And it's really cool to have this growing community of people. They're mostly the same, but still different enough to keep you interested in the individuals and get you to care about each individual as they are, because they're all different and they all exemplify different traits that you can relate to. I just think it's a really, really interesting book with a concept that I haven't seen before and an implementation that I think is just perfect. Like, it's just so well done. And I just love it.
I think this leads to the first point, going to this bigger discussion of what makes good sci-fi. That sci-fi, we kind of had this discussion with Rendezvous with Rama, that like, it explores a space, not just space itself, but like, it explores a space of thought you haven't gone to yet, right? Like, I've never thought about all these things that would be true if I was a self-replicating probe.
Yeah.
You know, and I've never thought about all the dynamics of space exploration at this scale. And I've never thought about, you know, how I would weaponize the metal when I'm fighting other space probes. You know, and so just being involved in that new area of thought.
Yeah.
You know, just that fun exploration, because I think the way you said it before was, you know, there's not really a lot of spaces to explore left on Earth, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
We've been everywhere, we've seen everything, we can go to YouTube and see all these places, you know, like, there's not new experiences in that way kind of left in our reality, if you will.
Right, right.
So it's...
And graspable at such at a level that most people can grasp, you know? Right. It's like, I feel like exploration is dissipating as we have ways to see it all.
Yeah. And of course, you know, travel's still great and still fun, and I love going new places and seeing new things, but the excitement of the new.
Yes.
When the sci-fi can get you the excitement of the new, or even just something different that you've never experienced before, that's a good sci-fi.
Yeah.
And Babaverse is awesome at this one.
Okay.
It, and that's why I enjoyed it so much. Is it got me thinking about things I've never thought about, and I just smiled through every one of them, you know? Yes. I just loved it. I just loved going, yeah, I would do that. Or no, that wouldn't make sense. You're right. I would need to do this. Or yeah, I would have set this over here, etc. So that was one of the favorite things about the book.
I agree. And yeah, no, that's basically it. I agree. There's nothing else to say, really. It's perfect. And that's what I crave. Yeah, that's what I crave in science fiction is the exploration of the new and the exploration of the even concepts that are still here, but in this new light that can clarify things, you know?
Yeah. Or like, again, because I'm a physics major, and so I understand a lot about the actual physics of space and things, but I haven't pieced it all together, you know? Mm-hmm. So Rendezvous with Rama, this book, there's things they talk about where this time delay or other things that are going on, and you're just like, oh yeah, like, you would need to do that. I would never have thought of that until I was in this space, in this realm, but yeah, I would need to account for this factor and this factor and this factor, and getting to put those all together in application is a really fun piece of it.
Yes. Speaking of things that I hadn't thought about before, that leads almost perfectly into my question. One of my questions that I thought of. My question for you is, what would your first version 2's name be? Because in the book, Bob, when he replicates, the next, if you wake up and you're not Bob, you're the next version of Bob, you're the clone of Bob, what are you going to call yourself? Because we can't all be Bobs.
Right.
And they all have different names, and so they all have different markers. If you woke up and you weren't David, you were David 2, what would you call yourself?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Yeah. I still haven't resolved an answer for myself.
You know, I've always liked the name Benjamin for some reason.
Benjamin.
So I think Benjamin would be my number 2.
Amazing.
I think Jason is also one I've liked for some reason.
Okay.
Although when I say that, everyone thinks of like, isn't there like a murder
character
that's Jason?
Yeah, he's
I know plenty of people named Jason. That's the right answer. maybe Jason would be my warmongering space probe. You know?
Beautiful. Yes. Yeah. God, let's just kill them all.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Benjamin's a solid one.
Benjamin.
I think Benjamin would be one of mine.
Just because you like it, just because
I've always liked the name for some reason.
That's awesome.
It just has a lot of the flow of the name has multiple consonants that fit well together. You know, like any middle name, and it works because like it's self-contained. You know, there's other names where like the middle name kind of fights against your first name because it's like a repeat of syllables or something. I don't know. I just like the name.
That's awesome. I never considered that it actually does kind of have a nice flow to it. Like it's its own contained, like nice little flow. Benjamin.
Yes.
It's got enough going on that it feels like it can be it's like kind of a standalone thing.
Plus there's plenty of good Bens and literature and sci-fi.
Yeah.
We won't get all that though.
No.
What's your pick? Do you have one? Do you have an estimate?
Oh.
Approximation?
Oh, mine's... The first one, honestly, the first one that jumps to mind is really quite nerdy, but I might pick Tron.
Nice.
As my first replicant's name. Just to be like, I like this one
as soon as
you
call and you say, you serve the user.
User. And then we can have Clue, and we can have some of the other, Flynn. Oh, Flynn would be a good one. Because that's the family name or whatever.
Right.
And so, of the guys who, Tron things. But Flynn would be a good one.
Nice.
Oh.
I might go into Lord of the Rings realm, strangely, if I did. Because we're talking explorers. So
yep, exactly.
You might get into Frodo's and Sam's and Aragorn's.
Amazing.
I know you have more on your list, so keep throwing your questions at me. I want to know what you were analyzing.
Right. Oh, man, it was just fun questions, because it was like, I really think it, again, it personalizes all these concepts that you don't think about, you don't plan on.
Right.
But when you relate to the character and he is relatable, all of a sudden, like, you can put yourself in these situations. So one of the other situations Bob gets put in is he finds a human-level intelligent species, or, you know, growing into human-level intelligent species on another planet. And one of the storylines is what Bob does about and with this finding these people. You know, he doesn't take the no interference protocols. You know, he goes and he starts to mess around. And so the question is, what would you do if you ran into you're exploring the universe and all of a sudden you find another intelligent race? Like,
so to clarify a little bit, the reason he wants to intervene. Is because there's predators that are killing off all the semi-intelligent humanoid creatures.
Mm-hmm, they're about to be wiped out.
Yeah, so they're like kind of on the verge of evolving into a civilization, but there's predators that are killing them faster than he thinks they'll be able to survive.
Right, thank you.
So that's why he decides that he's going to intervene and kind of keep them alive and hunt the predators for them, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Lead them to resources and all this stuff.
And that opens Pandora's box of problems.
Yeah.
But.
And some things are good and some things are bad. And
Would you take the same path that he took or would you change?
That's a good question. You totally made this much more personal. I could have answered that in an academic way if you had said, like, what are the implications of this action?
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
So now you make me make a decision?
Yeah.
No, that is good. Oh, yeah, it's hard. I don't know. I don't know if I would have taken any different actions than he did. I think I would have probably intervened. But it's also hard because you don't as the reader, you don't see everything, obviously, that he has knowledge of.
Right.
And I think I would, in some regard, try to. Because part of me is like, if they're that level of intelligence, then we have kind of the same human need to protect others. You know, like we've evolved in various ways as a society, as humans, to look out for one another, right? And they kind of have that natural instinct to protect and value life. I think if I saw life at that level of understanding, that I'd feel that same urge as a human to, you know, shepherd and guard and protect. But
okay,
that's an interesting question. What would you do?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. He's just, it's, I feel the same way as like, it's the perfect situation to put Bob in, because what else is he going to do? Like, how could he let potentially the only other human-level intelligent species just die out? Like, how could he just let that happen?
Right.
But at the same time, like, Sky God, though? But, like, did you... I feel like his hand was too personal in the way that he handled it. I think it wasn't mystical or mysterious enough.
Right.
I think it was a little too, like, hands-on, like...
Right. He basically becomes... Like, one of his little probes that he sends down to the Earth can, like... He, like, ends up talking with them directly.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, that's true. That is a good point. I think, again, if we had all the information, I assume there's got to be some way you could do that and guard them without them really knowing who you are. You know?
Right, right. And without the need to hurry it along. I feel like he hurries it along a little too fast.
Yeah.
He's just, like, within one... lifetime of these people, he's like really pushing them through and really getting it going.
It's true, because he has all the time in the world. He can wait out generations, as long as he's protecting them.
But he got too personally involved, too tied in.
Yeah, this brings me to another point, but I have some angst to let out. So get to your other questions first, and we'll come back to the.
Any of them are worth
the space people.
See, blah, 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 blah. My only other question is, like, putting yourself in Bob's shoes, how would you feel, A, about meeting yourself, and B, about yourself being a little bit different every time it came out, like, a little different version of you? How does that make you feel?
I love how personable your questions are. I was expecting this to be, like... Again, like an academic discussion.
No. Just take your doctor somewhere else.
Yeah, I'll take my doctor mentality away. No, you're good. That'd be interesting. I think I would enjoy it in weird ways. Okay. Because, you know, you do always wonder, like, oh, what if I was just like, for me, like, what if I was just a little bit more athletic? Like, would that have changed my outlook in life? Like, would I have been more in sports in high school and less involved in academics, and thus wouldn't have gotten a PhD, you know? Or what if I was, you know, this trait or this trait a little bit more? So I think it'd be kind of fun, personally, to see, like, I think it'd be weird. Like, don't get me wrong. That first experience would be weird. But, like, after a while, to see, like, the different dials of your personality go up or down, it'd be fun to have, like, this kind of space of you that is, like, all the extreme versions of yourself. Yeah. Like, I don't know. It'd be fun to analyze. Like, oh, yeah, maybe I am a little bit too much based on this guy. You know, I do value, you know, rules too much or what, you know, whatever it may be. But, so I think it'd be fun to have, like, a standard deviation away from your personality and be able to analyze all the versions of you.
I love that, because that's you actually might have just changed my mind on it, because I was actually kind of the opinion of, like, I do not want to meet myself. And I especially don't want to meet myself when I'm hangry or when I'm feeling particularly apathetic.
Right.
Or, like, I don't want to meet these people. Like, they're fine. They live in me. But the chance to see, like...
What you could have been.
What you could have been, yes. Like, the potential for that is just, like, it's a path that you shouldn't trod, but I want to. Yeah, want to know, like, what could have happened and what could have been. And now, and that's the way you could see it. So you changed my mind. And that would be, that would be.
Now, to be fair, this version of me would like to see it. There's probably other versions of me that are less academically minded that would not like to see versions of me. So.
Well, it's such a, it's such an interesting thing, because, spoiler, he does, like, as he goes through the books, as they make more replicants, it does actually kind of, the replicative drift gets more and more extreme.
Right.
And so, because each version is a watered-down version, and eventually you just have water. You don't have whatever you started with. And it's really interesting to see the eventuality of his exact question that he poses in the first book, of, like, what's it like meeting yourself, and what's it like when yourself has different personalities?
Right.
And what does that eventually lead to? And it's so interesting.
Nice.
But every good book review and movie review has some complaints. So what you got?
Let's take a break first.
Okay.
So, I decided to take a break for a second because I'm about to start probably a controversial topic to me and Aaron on something I consider not good sci-fi.
A controversial topic. This is going to be good, people. So this might be our first fight. I'm
just kidding. So I need to be ready. So we took a break. All right. So let's just jump into it, because I don't know how else to lead it.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. A little disjointed. Whatever. Fine.
So in the Babaverse, as you were describing, there's this whole storyline narrative, which actually takes place with the original Bob himself, where he finds that civilization, or that, not civilization, but those subhumans. That sounds horrible. You know, people that have not quite become humans yet, have not quite become intelligent.
You could call them a civilization, I think. I think that's within the bounds of a civilization.
They're on the verge of becoming an intelligent civilization, but he's trying to help this still tribal, semi-intelligent beings on this planet. And it's interesting storyline stuff. And also, in Space Odyssey, it starts, okay, spoiler, some alien intervention that helps early humans become humans, okay?
Oh, you're a genius.
You don't even know what I'm saying yet.
I'm starting to figure it out.
But here's my question.
Okay.
Does that really count as sci-fi? I don't like when it jumps backwards and talks about evolutionary stuff. And, you know, Bobverse is a weird in-between, because it's half, you know, it's in the future with a different species.
Right.
But it's focused on, like, their evolutionary story.
Okay.
And Space Odyssey is focused on our evolutionary story. But I don't like that. I don't want to read about apes and, you know, like, people swinging through trees and stuff. Like, it just doesn't feel like it belongs in a sci-fi book. I don't know. So that's my complaint is, I get it. I think it's appropriate to put it in there, but I just don't like it. I don't want to read about it. I want to read about cool stuff going on with tech and all these things. I don't want to read about, like, alternate history, evolutionary stuff. I don't know.
What? And so is 2001 just an alternate history?
The first half is.
Is all science fiction?
Also alternate history?
Alternate history? Alternate future history? This is getting... Okay. Oh, boy. Okay.
Okay, but I want to know... What was... You thought I was a genius a second ago.
I just didn't realize that is almost the exact same situation, just in the future. That's almost the exact same situation in 2001 right. Space Odyssey. And Bob meeting the...
The Delphians?
Is that the Deltons. Yeah, he calls them the Deltons because they're on, like, the planet, or the star is, like, Delta Eridani or something like that. So he just calls them the Deltons. Kind of like we'd be called Earthlings. It's kind of the same. Yeah.
Anyway, so when he meets the Deltons, it's like...
Right. It's the exact same storyline.
It's amazing. I didn't realize that.
External intelligence comes and intervenes on their behalf to help them survive long enough to become intelligent.
Exactly, exactly.
But I don't enjoy it. I don't know. I want to read about future stuff. I'm not as interested in the history, the prehistory that led here.
So then, does your complaint, like, does that carry through your whole feeling about 2001? Or does it rest in the beginning chapters?
It rests in the beginning chapters.
Okay, okay.
Same with Babaverse. It's like, the rest of Babaverse is fine. It's just, I don't really care for this story arc
that much.
Yeah. And Space Odyssey, I actually skipped in the movie. I skipped the entire first, like, 30 minutes where it's going through the whole prehistory stuff.
Well, so. It's a good thing you didn't skip much.
So, I guess, should we probably jump into Space Odyssey a little bit? Or do we need to finish this conversation?
No, this conversation, I gotta wrap my head around it. You just don't like it. Wait, but don't you... See, I see it as it makes sense to me to have it, because science doesn't just live in the future, it also does live in the past. Like, science is the theory of science is an explanation for what drives all of humanity and what has created the world around us. And so,
I think my problem is, science fiction in itself relies on an unjustifiable premise. We are at some point in the future
that's true
that has all this technology, and we don't explain where it came from. We have alien species. We don't explain where it came from.
Right.
Where they come from. That's fine. We're starting it on some unsettled premise.
Right.
And seeing what happens from there. We put all the pieces on the table and say, if this were here, this is what would happen. And we let them all interact. Uh-huh. Right? So I don't care how they got there. I don't care, like... How, you know, I don't care how the pieces got on the table. I don't know. It's just...
Interesting.
I just want to see, I put the pieces on the table, how does the game play? You know? That's the interesting part to me. That's the fun part to me.
So, wait. Okay, people, another spoiler alert coming at you. Because I'm about to bring another book into this that we've both read some of. Well, I've read all of it. Children of Time... Adrian Tchaikovsky.
This is also one I hate.
Of course it's one you hate.
That's why I didn't finish it.
But
this actually is a perfect point. The whole book. Okay. Children of Time.
Okay.
There's two simultaneous storylines. I'll focus on the one I didn't like and why I quit the book.
Okay. Yeah.
There's some spaceship that crashes that has like a chemical agent that helps things evolve faster.
Yeah, it's basically
give or take a few details.
that's beautiful, but yeah, that's a beautiful short explanation.
Right, and so one of these spaceships crashes on a planet or one of these planets, and the spiders are the ones that get this super evolution chemical that help them evolve faster. So they start to become the intelligent species. And so the whole book is like how the spider species develops and like starts to learn how to communicate and starts warring with each other. And I couldn't care less for it.
But
what? Which is why I stopped reading it. Because I know what's going to happen. Like, we've seen how civilization got to here.
Mm.
And so we're just seeing the same thing repeating. It's like reading a history textbook, and then they did this, and then they did this, and then they learned how to do this, and... Aaron is so mad at me right now, but he can't let out his...
Mad, I just don't even know what to say. Okay. See, this doesn't actually surprise me having you explain this way, because Children of Time really does take the logical course of humanity
and shows it through
another race, another civilization, and other ways that they might have accomplished the same kinds of goals and the same evolved through the same kinds of issues with a different culture evolving.
Right. And they have different body structures and different
right. Well, and see. this is really interesting because, honestly, with a lot of Adrian Tchaikovsky's books, my favorite parts about them have been the culture. He dives into culture, into dynamics. I think he was an entomologist. I'm not sure about that. But I think that was one of his careers before he started writing. And so, like, bugs.
Right.
He knows a lot about bugs. And one of his other series revolves almost solely around culture and bugs. And so that's the part that I find really interesting. But I almost... But does it disqualify from science fiction? Is that science, like, is it necessary for science fiction to talk about culture? Like, is that a part of science fiction that we value, or that is a necessary part of science fiction? Because I feel like my answer is absolutely, because that's the only part that I feel like really matters long term.
So I think this is part of my problem, though.
Okay.
Going into your description, I think Children of Time is a good one to focus on. Okay, it's especially our conflicting interests.
Exactly.
Because, so, for example, I remember one of the scenes in Children of Time. One of the lead spiders is talking to another spider from another region or tribe.
Yeah.
And they're having this, like, debate or, you know, threatening each other, basically.
Yeah.
And they're communicating by vibrating the webs that they're both sitting on. And they've learned how to communicate through vibrating their web strings and holding onto it. And they've learned this whole language so they can talk to each other and et cetera. And, like, that's cool. That's an interesting idea that the spiders would use that. But the end result is that the spiders still fight with each other and... they develop very similar to humanity, and like they fight over resources, and their predators also fight over those same. Like, it's just the same story because they have to evolve in that way. But like, there's not a whole lot of new things to tell in that story that interest me. And maybe if I got a little bit farther, the end game would be more interesting. But I just
no. I think if you want to be interested in that one, you should skip to the next book. Honestly. I don't think you'd even miss much skipping to the next book.
See, and that's part of the problem. Because it's just telling the same story that humanity had to go through and just altering slight pieces of it. It tells me about what a different humanity would have done, but it's not like a commentary on my humanity, you know? Our society, I don't know. So going to Space Odyssey, same thing. Like,
okay,
the aliens intervene and they give the primitive humans basically tools and weapons to help them survive against, I think it's like leopards that are hunting them. Or
yeah, I think it was leopards, yeah.
Anyways.
Quite finished the book, so.
but guess what? Whatever. They use the tools and they use the weapons and they beat the predators and they become evolved and like...
Voila.
Like, why did I need 4 chapters describing that to me? You know, like, the end game is predictable. The solution has to be the one solution of survival. And they all get there through the same mechanisms. This prehistory.
Interesting.
Especially the evolutionary kind of history. It doesn't excite me. But what does excite me is for once they do become civilized... and they start building spaceships, and some of the things they do differently, like in Rendezvous with Rama, or if you've ever read Hail Mary Project, and he meets that species, and the things that are different at that level. How does their civilization, their technology, their space exploration, again, meeting in the sci-fi realm, is interesting to me. But how they kind of got there, I don't know. I couldn't care.
Interesting. No, this is very... I find this concept interesting because I've been having these feelings lately, honestly, outside of all this stuff. One day, I just kind of was thinking about the world as it stands right now, and I was like, you know what? This all feels very inevitable. it feels like this is absolutely what was going to happen. No matter what.
Right.
It was a very uncomfortable feeling for a minute. I was just like, this is this was always how it was going to be. And I, well, it just like the logic of how everything worked together just seemed to be concrete. Like it just was like, this is obviously how it was going to happen. Yeah. Like how could you expect it to happen differently?
Right.
Is kind of how I feel. And honestly how I've been feeling about a lot of things lately, which is very strange. I don't like it.
Determinism is not a great mentality to have in life.
It's, don't worry, it's complicated up in this head of mine. But let me see if I can understand this. So you don't care. Do you care if the end result is different than humanity as we see it today? Like if we start these stories from the same point, but and go through some of the same problems, does it change your feelings if they end up someplace different than humanity is today?
Yes. I think the problem is not so much the content as much as it is the storyline, right? Like, like you said, it's a very predictable storyline until they get to the end game of their civilization. Uh-huh. And that's the point where I get interested, is what do these civilizations do that's different than ours?
Uh-huh.
And I guess getting there, they would have to do different things. But I think it's just the dryness of the storyline itself is what gets me. So I don't. Yeah,
that's fair. That's fair, because that's also a complaint I can see with Children of Time, where it's like it is kind of like if you're not really invested in the spiders and not really invested in the characters that he tries to develop, because he tries to develop characters that last through evolutionary timelines, which is. I'm very impressed that he even pulled it off. I think he pulled it off. But like, if you don't feel invested in any of that, the rest of the storyline is not really there. There's not really anything to follow along with. And that's kind of, so that's why they skip so much in 2001 A Space Odyssey, because like, that's like...
Everything just falls into place after that.
Right, we're going to have this one conversation with this object, and then that's the only time we're going to have this conversation. And the next time we're going to talk about it is the next time we meet this thing. Like, after all of humanity's evolution has brought us to a point where it's time to take the next step with the help of our alien friends. Question mark. Masters.
We're jumping around, so we got to decide. Are we ending this conversation or are we jumping into Space Odyssey?
Wait. Oh, I had a revelation and it's gone. Gosh, dang it. It was there. Like, I had this, moment where I was like, you're a genius. I'm a genius. We're geniuses in this moment. I was like, this is the moment where I understand everything. It's gone, though. I don't understand everything anymore. And, I don't know, David. This is getting me up all up and all twisted up inside.
I will say this. I said... Is it good sci-fi? I think it definitely can be good sci-fi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's definitely like a personal angst. Like,
yeah,
I can agree on that. It's my own vendetta. Like, it definitely could fit. But because you're starting the past, I know where it has to go.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start with the future, which is the best part about sci-fi, is you don't know where it's going.
Right.
You know? And so if you're limiting yourself to a storyline that's based solely in history, even if it is alternating in some ways, you're really limiting what the outcome can be, right? But with sci-fi in general, you want to look at the future because there is no limit on the outcome, and that's what excites me, not the storylines of the past.
Well, and I hate to agree with you right now. I'm a little cross with you, but I tend to agree, because that's like why else would you listen to science fiction? Like, that's
right.
I was actually having this conversation with my dad over a discussion we had about 2001 A Space Odyssey, where it was like realizing the actual point of science fiction, like I've come to realize like what the hope and the dreams of science fiction are. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's the hopes and dreams are what we can become. Like, what can happen? The boundless future, like it's just, it could be anything, it could be amazing. And to counter that, the great fear of science fiction is expressed in most of the books, where it's like, humanity will destroy itself
right.
before we actually get there, before right. we can realize the grand, glorious future that we could have as a spacefaring civilization, and that we could achieve increasing technology to the point where it solves so many problems and all the problems right. that we have. And what new problems will that create and face? And I hate to agree with you, but it's, that is why we listen to science fiction. That is the dream of science fiction.
Right.
Is that the future will be better and brighter, not to go running through the past some more.
Right.
Because we have already had the past. So in Bobaverse, like you're saying, you're not that interested in the storyline with the Deltons.
Right.
It's not too, you know, it's kind of going through the past. We're covering stuff, ground that's already been covered. The narrative's a little dry. It's predictable. Why doesn't Bob add the little bit of interest that you need to keep it interesting? Because I feel like him messing with it
is the interesting part.
Is the interesting part. Yeah. Is the part where he modifies their evolutionary track. Because he talks about the true predictable outcome being that the Deltons won't survive, that they'll just die out, and that will be the end of this intelligent race.
I don't know. I can't give you a good answer. It just doesn't...
As it goes, yeah.
It just doesn't tickle my fancy.
And that's okay. Like, I don't...
I want to give you a logical answer, though, at least that peers into my soul. I think it just goes back kind of to the same thing with, like you're saying, with expectation of sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
When I go into the book reading Bobaverse or Space Odyssey, I'm expecting something about my society, our society in the future, the implications of that. And if there are external forces from aliens or whatever it may be, how those affect it, right? Again, putting all the pieces on the table and see how the game plays out. When you jump into a story about people that haven't evolved yet, it doesn't tell me anything really about us. It tells me something about them. Even though Bob's interacting with them, and that's interesting. It just is telling their story some more, not ours. And even with like Space Odyssey, where again there's an alien vessel that comes down and teaches the primitive humans that are supposed to be us how to use tools and weapons, basically.
Right.
Even that, like, that's an interesting, like, again, it's needed for the rest of the story, which we'll hopefully get to at some point in this conversation. But it doesn't tell me anything about society right now. It's like, okay, that explains, I guess, how he got here. But I don't care that, you know, primitive man number one was able to kill the leopard with the tool he got from the alien. Like, I don't need to hear that. Because it's all it's saying is that, hey, aliens talk to us in this story.
Yeah.
That's great, but like, jump back to my society, our society, and its future. That's cool that the spiders and Children of Time are talking with each other, but that doesn't tell me anything about what's going on right now with us and our future.
So, the concept that we got where we are was not the natural consequence of things. That doesn't tickle your fancy.
No, because I don't learn anything from it. I'm forever the academic mind, Aaron. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that makes sense, actually, because it really doesn't. It doesn't change anything, which kind of goes, yeah, that actually goes back to some of the things I've been really been thinking about on my personal life, where it's like, you couldn't have changed it. We are where we are, and we want to know what it's going to be. We want to explore what it's going to be.
Right.
And what it could be and how we could change for the better and for the worse. And that's what you're looking for in science fiction.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Sorry, I don't mean to make you, like, again, deterministic or fatalistic in this conversation.
You have not been doing that. That is just, it's just been on my mind.
And again, I think it's, if you want to talk about it, great, but I think it's the time. It's the amount of time. It's the amount of storyline. That's fair.
And you didn't want to spend a whole book on it.
I didn't want to spend a whole book on it. You know, I.
And Babaverse was tolerable because it was only one.
Yeah, one of many storylines.
Interesting, interesting.
And Space Odyssey was tolerable because it was only the first part of the story.
Okay.
But Children of Time, that one got me because it's the whole
flipping book. Yeah, yeah. I might have to recommend the second book of that series to you, and we might have to read that one.
Okay.
I don't know if I can, though. The second book is so hard to follow. It's like a really difficult book to follow at the beginning. And I think, honestly, the concept that it talks about is why it's hard to follow. And that's just how it is. But this conversation actually makes me really excited to hear your thoughts about the Foundation series.
Oh,
I'm so excited to hear your thoughts about it once we read that one. Because it's on our list, and I'm really excited to hear what you have to say about it. I have no guesses as to whether or not. I don't know if you'll like it or not.
I was going to say, I should warn you, I have tried to read the first few chapters of that.
Oh, yeah?
And I have some concerns. But that conversation is going to have to happen another day.
Yep. I don't know. You know, that one's a classic. And my knowledge to it is probably 4 or 5 books in, and so I don't remember specifics, but I know where the story goes, and so
I might push through it. You might have to.
It's a classic, though. Oh my gosh, if there's a series that is like on that precipice of classical sci-fi, of like it's kind of old, but it also like, and it, the concepts are a little like not so much the Bob sciences of like, oh, what can we do with technology? It's a little different. The whole concept is a little bit different, a little more classical sci-fi, but oh my gosh, it's a trip. It's a big long it's a big trip. So I'm really excited for that.
Nice. Okay. We gotta get to Space Odyssey before we run out of time.
Right.
We're already like running over time, but seriously. I need to get your thoughts.
Okay. So, to preface this, I have only watched the movie and read the first few chapters of the book, and you've read the whole book and watched the whole movie.
Yeah, so we actually had opposite experiences, because I read the book first, mm-hmm. then watched the movie, and Aaron watched the movie first, and then yep. started the book. But, short summary, there are 3 major sections
yep.
of Space Odyssey. The first, as you've heard us mention many times, is a whole little section about how primitive man interacts with some kind of alien vessel that comes down and teaches them
yep.
how to survive, basically.
Yep.
The second section of Space Odyssey is about a kind of hush-hush discovery that happens on the moon.
Yeah.
You're following a scientist that kind of is making his way towards the moon. Man kind of lives on the moon now and on Earth, so it's like an airport almost. You can fly to the moon if you want, come back, etc.
Yep.
And
the future hopes of humanity.
He goes to the moon and he's meeting in all these secret meetings about something that is found on the moon.
Yeah.
And it's this anomaly that has this huge magnetic field around it, and you go and you look at it and you realize it's kind of that same vessel that was talked about in part 1. And it lets out this huge radio signal as soon as it's first seen by the sun. And then it just cuts.
Right, yeah.
And then the third section is probably the section most people will think about when they think about Space Odyssey, is where you have a small team of people on a ship. They're flying out to Jupiter, and they have the robot named Hal that's an onboard intelligence. So that's probably what people most associate with Space Odyssey is
right.
Hal, which famously goes haywire and tries to kill the crew.
I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that. You know how many times I've been told that in my life?
Quoted in that same way? Because I didn't make that connection. I'm so sorry.
No, that's fine.
For all of our culture and society, I apologize that this is how it has to be.
Anyway, so huge spoiler. In the third part, after they survive Hal trying to kill them, the last remaining crew member, Dave, I can't remember his last name, continues past Jupiter to one of its moons, where they realize the signal was sent to, that radio blast from the vessel was sent, and they're trying to figure out what is on that moon of Jupiter that was trying to communicate with.
Right.
And we'll talk about the ending later. Okay, but okay, yeah. That's the main, those are the main three sections.
Yeah.
And so, as I mentioned, could not care less for the first section.
Yeah.
The second section is interesting, and but like the main section is really that third section that I think was the most interesting.
Yeah.
But this was my biggest thought on Space Odyssey, reading the book.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's Arthur C. Clarke, who is awesome at that piece-by-piece discovery aspect of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did that pretty dang good in the second and third parts.
Okay.
It wasn't Rendezvous with Rama, by any means.
Okay.
And it's still an older an older book, so some of the things that are interesting to them in the past would not be interesting to us. But we have to remember that this is written before, like, man had landed on the moon.
Right.
So, like, the whole idea of, like, a centrifuge rotating to create, like, artificial gravity was probably mind-boggling back then. Yeah, like, yeah. We see that all the time now, but you have to keep this in context of, like, mid-60s. Like, this is amazing stuff to be writing about. And I think that's what surprised me most was how accurate he was on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Given that we hadn't even really traveled to space at that point.
Right, right. We'd only been taking little dips and little trips.
But yeah, even like he guessed the population of the Earth correctly in the year 2001. Like his description of neural networks even was like creepily good for Hal. Like it even like had me start distrusting AI, and that's what I work with. So. Which is why everyone distrusts AI is because of things like Space Odyssey. Yeah. And so, I think overall, my thoughts on Space Odyssey is it's really amazing if viewed from a 1960s lens, which is why I think it's such a cultural icon, because it was so amazing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, like, if you went into it blind and didn't have any cultural context, I don't think most people would be, like, amazed at this book or movie as they read or watch it.
Right, right. Well, that is definitely... I think I agree. Having not, again, not completed the book, I still feel like I agree with that, because it's on the one hand, like when I watched the movie, for example, all the science fiction concepts I've already explored lots of times in every situation. Like, this is none of this is new to me. Like, Space Odyssey is a very highly referenced, even the images, even the scenes. I've seen all these shots before, almost. Not all of them. Some of them really took my breath away, though. And viewing it through the 60s lens, it was like, this looks amazing.
Right.
How did they make this? This is beautiful. They didn't have
modern
CGI. This movie is amazing. It looks beautiful. And there's weird things that, like, obviously don't work, like, or that we don't employ, or that just...
Like the Velcro shoes. Oh, the ships and stuff.
I don't know when Velcro was made, but that must have been the bee's knees when that came out. I was like, oh, yeah, obviously, you have Velcro shoes. And, like, now most science fiction just skips over the whole how do you navigate. Like, oh, you just float around. Like, why would you... try to walk in zero gravity. Like, that doesn't... It's not how zero gravity or microgravity is. Like,
anyway, I cut off your...
All good, all good. Well, and coming to the conclusion of the movie, I was livid. Because I was so frustrated. Because I felt like I had no idea what was going on the whole movie.
Right.
The whole movie, I'll be honest, just really... My dad described it really well. A series of beautiful vignettes about the story, not a cohesive narrative. Right. Like, it doesn't feel like it has a cohesive narrative, because it's just like it literally feels like it's broken into the three sections, and it's like, okay, here's early man, and that's it, and you're like, okay, and they discover how to use tools, and you're like, okay, cool, very nice. Like, obviously the thing has some role to play in teaching them how to use tools. Okay, cool, whatever.
Right.
And then we go to the next section. It's like, okay, big board meeting to talk about a thing on the moon. It was like, this meeting so long. The whole time I was sitting there, I was like, I don't want to be sitting in a meeting right now. I want to be watching a movie. And then we go to the third section. It's like, okay, Hal, all the Hal stuff. And I'm like, okay, yep, that's, I've seen all that. Yep, I know how that goes. Like, okay, whatever. I just didn't feel like there was any kind of cohesive narrative to tie it all together to make it make sense. And I was complaining, and I bring these complaints to my dad because he's the only other person, like he's one of the only other people, including you, that I can talk to these kind of sci-fi things about, especially because that's like, you know, his childhood. He knows it. He's familiar with it. He loves it. So we're talking about it. And I started to appreciate the movie when he gave me the 60s glasses to look at it through and to show that this is not the first, you know, we just had Dune. Like, this isn't Dune. Like, Dune was amazing. This isn't any of the amazing things I've seen. It's just kind of, it's like frustrating. And he shows me through his glasses, like, what it was like to see it in the 60s and in the 70s. And it was like, oh, I came to this realization of like, wow, this is incredible. And so I feel like I agree with your concept of that it needs that context to be properly appreciated and to be, to show its true value.
Right.
Overall.
And like you said, you've seen so many things that it explores in other sci-fi because it was the foundation for so many other sci-fi, right?
Right, exactly.
We're just stealing things from sci-fi. So,
right, yeah.
So yeah, like, and like you said, the movie especially is all about being the experience of space.
Yeah.
No one had really experienced space.
Yeah.
In our day, we see videos all the time. I show my students videos of astronauts on the International Space Station that talk about how they brush their teeth, and you gotta watch that, you know. And this isn't new to us, but like back then, who had never seen anything in space, the astronauts hadn't even been on the moon yet, you know.
Right. Like,
this is just mind boggling. And so it makes sense that they focused entirely on the experience and didn't really care about the storyline because everyone was probably just,
you
know, blown out of their minds at the visuals, you know.
Yeah.
And let's be fair, we've done that in movies past. 2001 Space Odyssey.
Right.
We won't talk about Transformers or
CGI
monsters, but
cannot talk about that. Oh,
but yeah. So I appreciate it as a foundation for a lot of other things and for what it was at the time.
Yeah,
a few things really throw it off though in terms of like long term standalone by itself sci-fi.
Okay,
even with the book. One of those things that is interesting is that the book was actually written at the same time that the movie was being developed. And I think that really throws off some of the pieces of it that would have normally been more tied together.
How do you mean?
So, for example, the three parts themselves. The jump from, like, going to the moon to them being on the spaceship going past Jupiter. I imagine that Arthur C. Clarke would have tied those two strings together a little bit more cohesively.
Okay.
If he knew he had time to do so in the movie. But because they knew they were time limited, I think the three chunks are kind of intentionally separated.
Interesting.
Because they knew what scenes they wanted, they knew they needed the technicality of developing those three scenes independently, and they knew they needed visuals for that, so they couldn't have time to do anything on Earth, for example, showing what people are doing on Earth about it. You know, there's limited resources in the movie, so there's limited space for it in the book.
Interesting.
I imagine, and maybe I'm wrong, but I imagine R.C. Clarke would have taken a little bit more time on some of the developmental concepts if he knew that they were going to be, that he could do so without worrying about it being in the movie. The ending especially is one of those things.
Really?
So the ending to 2001 Space Odyssey is probably one of the most confusing things you'll ever see or read. Much better in the book.
Oh, no.
It's a little bit better in the book, but not much better than the movie. So once Dave gets to Jupiter, this one of the moons where this radio signal was going, he basically falls into a galactic, like a portal that leads him to this area where he can basically jump in other portals to go anywhere around the universe, kind of thing. Like, it's a big hub for intergalactic space travel that someone has developed, one of these alien species. And then he goes through one, falls into one where the aliens take him and try and like give him a room that feels like normal space to him, like a room back on Earth, because they're trying to slowly teach him their ways, and he ends up becoming a child of the new aliens and is capable of doing superhuman things for Earth.
Yep.
And that's from the book. And from the movie, it's even worse, because it's basically just this 30-minute visual rainbow scene that eventually ends with him looking like a giant baby hovering over the Earth.
Oh my gosh. The movie was so... We were dying. I had my friend and my sister, we all watched it together, and we were just... The rainbow visual started, and we were like, how long is this going to last? Because we'd already been through the whole movie. We knew it was going to last a while. We start clicking. We fast-forwarded through most of it because it was so long. And there was no information. And I was like, Stanley! I'm at the end of the movie! And then it was space baby. And you're like, space fetus! Yeah! And I'm like, I don't understand!
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again.
And the books.
Visuals, I'm sure, were cool back then, but
they looked great even now.
Half an hour of rainbow colors going across the screen is nothing new to a modern observer.
I didn't need it, and I also didn't care. And yep.
And so I think that's another one again that breaks both the movie and the book, is just because there's no narrative there. There's no like ultimate conclusion. I think they were just going for, we need something cool looking, you know, and we'll throw it through this and we'll explain nothing. And again, I don't know what Arthur C. Clarke was thinking necessarily in the book narrative, but the movie couldn't care less about what the story was explaining at that point.
So then my question is, does that make you curious to read the next couple of books?
No.
Not at all. No. Interesting, because that gives more time and more opportunity for explanations and for things that could be happening. And so, just not even interested.
No, because I think, and even the book, like, I enjoyed reading the book, even though I had to have kind of that 60 mentality. It did make me appreciate, he's still really good at the, okay, you're on a centrifuge and you're running around on the centrifuge. These are some of the things you have to account for on the space station. Like, he explores that. And that's the fun part, again, of sci-fi, is like, oh yeah, what would I do in that situation? What would I need to account for? And he still does that well. But until, basically once Hal is taken down, it's just garbly gook. I'm sorry. And again, I really like Arthur C. Clarke and Rondi Bergeron, but I don't know what they were going for. It just makes no sense. And
All right.
But to his point, did it really need to? No.
No.
You know, they're going for the experiential thing, and that's great.
Right.
For 60s context, but standalone as it is, longtime classic, I don't think it will be so without the lens of where it came from.
Interesting. Because this is reminding me that we're different people. I don't usually need reminders, but you know, it's helpful nonetheless, because I value that experience so much, even to the detriment of forgetting about other things. Like, I don't care about other things as much as just the experience. And the movie was almost that experience, but it lacked cohesive narrative. And as I've been reading the book gives me both right now. So I'll be interested to see how it ends and see my thoughts on the same concept. Because if it does kind of fall apart narrative wise, you need some sort of narrative to get the experience going. To have an experience, there has to be narrative. Otherwise, it's just stuff. No, it's like, I got a lot of stuff. I don't want more stuff. I want an experience. I want to feel amazed, and I'm really looking forward to it. This is really interesting. I'm finding it very interesting that you value things in science fiction very specific. Like, there's some very specific things that you really like, and things that you need to have, or else it's boring. Not interested. Right.
Which is also why sci-fi is so cool, though, right? Mm-hmm. That it can bring so much to the table if it's done well.
Yeah.
But that's also what can be detrimental, because there can be really crappy sci-fi books that don't bring anything to the table because they missed all the things right. they were supposed to bring, right? You the can... range of good sci-fi and bad sci-fi is tremendous compared to some right, other genres. Right.
Well, and if everyone shows up to Thanksgiving dinner with sweet potatoes, that's a very boring yeah. Thanksgiving dinner. And so, or if everyone comes with desserts, it doesn't have the same.
Right.
You're missing parts of the. And I agree. I agree 100%. So, of all the books and stories we talked about, do you think any of them are bad science fiction? Like, do you find any of them to the point of saying that they are not good science fiction?
So, if you took Space Odyssey and cut out part one,
okay,
and the last chapters, I think that's good science fiction. I really do think the rest is not that great, but and I would say for those that, okay. One more point about Space Odyssey, really quick.
Yeah,
those
yeah,
that
yeah,
are who have not seen it or read it, I do recommend reading it first before seeing.
Oh, 100%. Oh, my gosh. Do not watch that movie without having read the book. Unless you really just wanted, like, a screensaver.
Right.
Because the most beautiful screensavers I've ever seen. The most beautiful images, some of the most beautiful space images I've ever seen are in that movie. Right. But without the context, it's entirely frustrating.
Right. But yeah, answering your question, of all the ones we've read, going back to what we were saying, that can cover such a broad range of interests mm-hmm. and needs. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them are bad sci-fi.
Okay.
I think they all fill a niche.
Okay.
Or multiple ones that people want in their sci-fi experience.
Right.
Some of them don't fill the ones I want, like we talked about with Children of Time. But I think they're all good sci-fi, high-quality sci-fi.
Okay.
Some are lower quality sci-fi. I won't get into specifics, but some dystopians are really bad
yeah.
novels. Even if you can even qualify those as sci-fi, that's a different point.
So, yeah, a different debate. We've already discussed that off podcast.
but for me,
yeah,
right. I think we're reading high quality stuff.
Okay,
but for me, like you're saying, the two dials I want turned up high on sci-fi is. Mm-hmm. Explorations of new spaces, like okay. we talked about. New spaces of thought, new spaces of action.
Okay.
Getting that feeling of being somewhere new, being in space.
Right.
And
right.
The other dial is that kind of learning and social commentary on society dial. I like when those two are higher. Usually they're not okay. both high at the same time.
Right, but, right, right.
You know, and again, there's books like Fahrenheit 451 and 1984 and some of these other ones that, again, are they sci-fi? Are they not? I don't know. But certain ones of those I do like if they have enough exploration on top of the social commentary aspect of it. But
interesting. That's really, that's interesting, and that's going to color my the way that I recommend things as we go forward, because those are two pretty specific concepts that a lot of sci-fi does have, and so it is a good jumping point. But there, yeah, it does lack in some realms and some books.
Right.
Yeah.
I like another one that I like is the super technical, not the super technical, but like given my physics background,
yeah,
I enjoy when books. Apply that to the max and say, given the circumstances, or given these circumstances, these are all the things you, again, need to account for, you would need to calculate for.
Right.
And I like those technical aspects.
Yeah, yeah. Which that throws a wrench into recommending any space opera. Because, if you really like technical explanations of how things happen, space opera is not the one.
Yeah.
That's things like Star Wars and...
Right.
Those are space operas. That's a space opera. We're just like stuff in space.
A drama in space.
A drama in space. An opera in space. Yeah. It's dramatic. It's a story, but it's not about the science. It's not about the about the exploration and the being somewhere that we could actually feasibly maybe be.
Do you know specific dials? Would you say yours are similar, or is there other ones you're saying, oh, but I also like we talked about Children of Time and
right kind
of how did things get where they are? You seem to enjoy more than I do.
I think at least currently, for current me, I don't know for sure if this is how it's always been, but the cultural differences and developments in culture and the way that peoples interact culturally and how that shapes the individual, that's been a really interesting concept for me lately. And so things like Children of Time, that one's more of a cultural exercise rather than so much a science fiction exercise.
So, question for you.
Yeah.
So imagine, I don't know if this book exists. Maybe it does. Ooh. Imagine you took the alien species in Rendezvous with Rama, which we talked about in a previous podcast, but they're three-legged.
Right.
They're kind of, from what we can tell, are like spider-ish type creatures with three legs. If there was a book written about the Ramans themselves that's based on their planet and goes into their culture, is that something you'd want to read?
I don't know.
I hope that sound gets captured on the microphone.
I don't know. I don't see. So that's the culture is one of the dials. One of the other dials is, as you said, exploration. Like, and the kind of the mystery and the unsettling mystery. I think not. I think I wouldn't be interested in that because a lot of times when you actually start getting into, you take a concept like Rendezvous with Rama. It's like there's a spaceship floating around in space. And we're going to go explore it. That concept, the logical conclusion of that concept is to go into meeting the people or finally figuring out all the answers that you have, all the answers to all the questions that it brings up. But I have been so let down by the answering of the mysteries that I just want the mystery. Right. Like I just want the questions and the unsettling unknowns. Nature of space exploration and of things that could happen. And so it's, I think not, because I've been disappointed. I've been let down so frequently. And it's like, I love that unknown, that little spark of nothing that seems to prod your mind and to bug you and to make you a little bit afraid and a little bit excited. And it's that little spark of the unknown that I look for in my science fiction.
You're making me want to make a graph that takes every single science fiction book and like plots it on different traits of these different dials and aspects I've been talking about. And then we can start correlating which ones we like and not like.
You know, that might just be a thing that might just occur in the in the folder that are in our shared folders. Might have to start plotting all of our science fiction books that we read on different scales and different, giving them different rankings and ratings. And I think a grid. I think we could get a grid going like that, a coordinate system. I think we could do it.
This is getting way too academic.
You know, I gotta have some academic in my life.
But if we gotta solve problems, we gotta be clear and concrete on the solutions.
And nothing gets more concrete than science. Than actually plotting things on a graph. That's like, isn't that like pure science or something?
Nothing's real until I can assign a number to it.
Exactly. If it doesn't have a coordinate, if it doesn't exist in real space and I can't tell you where in real space that is, it doesn't exist. It's not real. If
I can't quantify it as a vector in some feature space,
exactly,
then it's not.
What's the point?
It's completely fake.
Exactly. It just it has no bearing.
It's complete imagination. Exactly. Completely subjective.
It must be scientific. Oh, that actually is an interesting, further interesting concepts.
I don't think anyone that's still listening at this point could care less about us making that graph.
Yeah, I agree.
But we'll do it.
It's just useful information. I just want to remember how I felt. Oh, I love it. I love science fiction. I think it's saving the world. It does so much work, honestly, to save the world. It really does. If nothing else, it entertains me. And an Aaron being entertained
is a good thing.
It's a good thing. It's a big step in the world being a better place. Click.